Where's the samba music?
Samba!
This is Juliette Kayyem with the Security Mom podcast brought to you by WGBH News. And that voice is Shira Springer, the sports reporter for Boston Globe, covering investigations and enterprise reporting, including the upcoming Rio Olympics. It's a formative moment for the Olympics. Not quite clear what's about to happen. You've been reading a lot about it. The Zika fears and crime fears and economic fears. And will they even have the stadiums done in time? Put it all together, and it is going to make for a very interesting 2 weeks. I've been fascinated with sports security since I got into Homeland Security. I have done a lot of it as an assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. Sports security is interesting because it combines a lot of fun with stuff we don't consider fun, like security. And for full disclosure, I was a security advisor for the very short-lived and ill-fated Boston 2024 Olympic bid. And these are complex situations for any reporter heading there, any reporter who's actually there to focus on sports. And so I wanted to sit down with Shira to learn from her as she goes to her fifth Olympics what we should be looking for. Shira leaves this week for Rio, and she'll be there covering it for a couple weeks. And she heads there right after a major sort of political transition, economic failure, political unrest, and Zika, that thing that we keep talking about. So it's been just the focal point of how people are thinking about the Rio Olympics.
Okay, so on a scale from disaster to unmitigated disaster to I can't believe that these Olympics are going forward, where would you put Rio right now?
Put it squarely in the middle.
In the middle.
Really, I mean, you know, it's funny because I hear from people who are have been out and about in the city and such mixed reviews coming in with regard to the readiness of Rio to host these games. On the one hand, you have the people who are, we'll call them the optimists, who are saying, wow, it's really not as bad as I expected. The venues look almost complete. And they're recalling a time when before the World Cup in 2014, when it was literally to the last minute, where soccer teams were arriving to stadiums and people were still hammering away at the stadiums to get them built and ready to welcome crowds. So that doesn't seem to be the case from what people can see from the outside. And then you have, let's call them the pessimists, who just see tons of problems waiting to happen once this machinery of the Olympics sort of gets going after the opening ceremony. They anticipate the problems will sort of, there'll be a domino effect with the problems. You know, there will be problems with the water, there will be problems with transportation, all problems that people anticipated, but they'll just come to life once the system is really, really taxed and everybody is trying to move about the city, get into venues, get through security lines, get where they need to be at the time they need to be there. They see just one problem rippling into another, into another, into another.
So this isn't your first time around the block?
You've not been my to, first rodeo.
Not your first rodeo?
They should
Rio?
Have rodeo, though,
right,
in the Olympics.
Exactly.
That would be awesome.
Okay, now you know why I like Shira. Gold medals in rodeo. It's kind of brilliant.
So you've been to several others. Is it always like this?
Yes.
I mean, okay, so you're not
yes.
like, okay.
Like, am I phased by all of the stuff, that all the reports that are coming out
yeah.
of Rio? Not. I mean, I would say this to me seems a little bit, the volume seems to be beyond 11, maybe it's at 12 or 13 at this point for the Rio Olympics, but there is always this sky is falling aspect to the pre-Olympic buildup. Because here's what you have. You have cities, for the most part, with very, very, very few exceptions, that have never, ever hosted an event this large, that has so many different facets to it. It's not just hosting a sporting event and putting on the games and putting on fair competition. It's bringing in 500,000 visitors to a city that may or may not have the capacity to host 500,000 visitors. It's bringing in tons of foreign dignitaries. It's bringing in tons of businesses and worldwide sponsors and big time execs. I mean, there's all these things going on. It's sort of like a big convention on top of a big sporting event on top of a big party. And it's all happening simultaneously in different parts of a vast urban area. And by and large, cities don't do that if at all. I mean, London was an exception. It was its third Olympics. If L.A. wins in for the 2024 Olympics, that'll be its third time, and, you know, the most recently in 1984. But you don't have a lot of repeat hosts. So it's a one-shot deal. They have to figure it out a little bit on the fly in some respect. Even though they're getting lots of advice from people who have done it before, it's still the city doing it for the first time, figuring out the logistics of everything for the first time.
So, I mean, of the litany of things that could go wrong, and you write, I mean, you write about sports.
There's quite a litany.
I know. So you write about sports, but you also are quite well known for sort of putting sports in the context of society at large. So, I mean, the list is infinite, but we've been talking about Zika, regular crime, pollution, potentially terrorism, and then, of course, a financial / political challenge that Rio has been going through. And, you know, we're hearing all about sort of like they can't pay the police.
Or the hospital workers. I mean, just think if... You know, something. I mean, at every Olympics, you always have a colleague or somebody who twists an ankle or a knee or gets violently ill for reasons that are just normal, like they ate something bad or they fell off a curb on a sidewalk and they have to use the local hospital system. And there are a lot of other people that happens to, too. And I'm thinking, well, gosh, there are problems with hospital staffing because of the financial and political situation. You know, what's going to happen if the hospitals get flooded with just minor injuries? I mean, all these things kind of compound over time.
So, but in the U.S., we've been so focused on Zika, it seems like maybe that's not even...
Is so far down my list.
See, that seems, you know, not insane, but just if you look at the media, you would think Zika is going to be the thing that keeps all Americans away.
It may be the thing that keeps all Americans away, but my personal... I mean, I'm more worried about the street crime aspect of it, because I just don't know how Brazilian officials, whether it's the federal police, local police, the army that they're bringing in, are going to safeguard all of the areas. And then you start reading about things. The latest I was hearing about just the security firm that was hired to man the X-ray checkpoints at the venues is a very inexperienced small company that's never taken on an event this big. And I think they were contracted on something like July 1st or late June. And that's
right.
That's almost criminal in and of itself, in the sense that you've got to train up thousands upon thousands of X-ray machine and security personnel in 4 weeks. Just poor planning on top of a bad logistical situation to begin with. So, I mean, they're the security aspect, the street crime aspect, in addition to just venue security, who's getting in, who's getting out, how are we getting in, how are we getting out, am I going to be in a two-hour line to go see a 20-minute competition,
right,
you know, are of bigger concern at this point. And am I going to be able to kind of get around Rio in a way I want to get around that's going to allow me to do meaningful reporting? Because if I'm just stuck in the Olympic bubble and I can only go to sort of what I would call sanctioned places,
right,
and places that the official transportation takes me to, then I'm not really doing a good service to the readership of the Globe. And that's disappointing. But on the other hand, I will say this. I've had more people before this Olympics say to me, don't do anything stupid.
Right. I think when people say don't do anything stupid, they probably mean, I know I can't convince you to not go, so I'm just going to say this because it will make me feel better. All you can do is hope that they are prepared. How are you preparing yourself? And how often does your mother call you worried?
Oh, my mom was a Jewish mom, so she calls me worried often. I could be running down the Charles and she's worried. So
you're doing her no favors.
No,
right?
No. I mean, I think the Olympic cycle drives her nuts. But you know, often, I would say daily.
Before Shira goes on, I have to stop here because she's about to unload about how she thinks about her own safety, smart precautions, and how she works with her employer, the Boston Globe, to maximize those precautions without undermining her own work. Right? She's a reporter. She needs to be out there, and it goes without saying she is also a she, right? So her concern for her own physical security may be more amplified than for a male reporter. It is a fine balance, and it's sort of remarkable to hear how she thinks about it and how she works with her Boston Globe editors about how to deal with the potential of safety and security concerns for the weeks ahead.
How am I preparing? So from the very simple thing, you know, I'm not sponsored by L.L. Bean, but I've got their no-fly, mosquito-proof garments. I've just got a handful of those shirts for those days when I will be covering potentially events that are waterside. You know, if I'm going out to cover rowing, I think I'll be in a sort of a mosquito-proof, quote-unquote, shirt. you know, a substantial supply of mosquito repellent that was recommended by Consumer Reports type of thing. So that on a, that level, I'm cloning all of my electronic mm-hmm. devices. So I have a computer with a clone that will remain at home, essentially, with all of everything set up, with all my settings and everything. Same thing with my phone, because I know that electronics theft kind of runs rampant there. Obviously, no jewelry, no expensive watches. I'll be, you know, bringing my plastic digital watch. I don't want to be wearing things that people will steal. Not that I would anyway, but I'm not going to be like having a lot of American flags on my clothing, just sort of generic branded clothing that you could get anywhere in the world, that type of stuff. I have talked with my editors just about what events can and can't cover in terms of with the track events, they tend, which I do, which is one of my specialty areas, they tend to get out quite late. So we're looking at, you know, 11, midnight, 1 a.m. End times for when I actually would wrap up my writing. And that would mean then catching a bus and going back an hour potentially, depending on the traffic, to where my hotel is. And that would be official Olympic transportation. But that would also mean staying out till potentially 2, 2:30, 3 a.m. In Rio. So we're talking about how often do we want to do that? Do we want to do that? Do we want to see how it goes one time and then make a call? So thinking carefully about how much we want to just be out and about late at night. And also it's a little difficult because don't forget, Brazil is in the winter now. So yeah. Sunset is about 5 o'clock. So it is dark early and for a long period of time.
Wow, I had not even thought about that.
Exactly. And a lot of these events, the big high-profile events, take place late
prime
at
time.
Night because they're prime time. You got it. You got it.
And so now, like, you know, now having had the experience of these, I mean, I can hear the enthusiasm in your voice. I mean, despite everything bad that we've been talking
well,
about.
Well, you sign up for the adventure. I mean, you do sign up for the Olympics and the sports,
yeah.
But part of the excitement is going into the unknown. I mean, as a reporter, do you want to go to an event and know how it's going to end? No. You want
your mother wants you to.
Yes, exactly. My mother would like to know what's going to happen.
Why can't you cover the school committee?
Yes, that's exactly the beat she would like me to have. And she would like me to be in bed every night at 9 p.m.
Right. Do you still get that Olympic feeling, even as a spectator or a writer? You're a chronicler of it.
Well, I will say, you know, the awe of the event. And I was lucky enough that Beijing was my first Olympic. So that was, and I went to the opening ceremony and that was yeah. quite an awe-inspiring opening ceremony.
Shira's talking about the 2008 Olympics in China. If you can't remember it, it was a remarkable and slightly terrifying Olympics. In particular, in its opening ceremonies, China wanted to make clear to the rest of the world how big and scary and militaristic and ideologically pure the country was. At one stage, it must have been about 10,000 men suspended by, you know, hangers were running in the air simultaneously in coordination like a militaristic Cirque du Soleil. It was beautiful. It was also kind of intimidating.
I would say the awe of the event has faded a bit, and I have become a little bit more cynical, but mostly because I've seen the inner workings of the IOC, yeah. the International Olympic Committee, and I really think it exploits the host country in many ways. I mean, this event, as much as they'd like to say this is going to be good for Brazil, I don't think there's any reporter who would say this is a boon to Rio. This is really going to tax the city, tax the country's economy. It has already. There are going to be social issues have already arisen out of the Olympics and how Rio has prepared for this and the way they're sort of policing the favelas and trying to clear homeless people from the streets. I mean, there's some very disturbing human rights issues that have cropped up, as they do with every Olympics. And, you know, Beijing, London, Sochi, even Vancouver, they were no exception. So while I enjoy the event and I like, you know, meeting people from different countries. I mean, when I was in London, I sat next to a guy from the Ivory Coast and we watched the opening ceremony together in the state. I mean, you get experiences that you wouldn't have any other place at any other time. On the other hand, I do worry about sort of the direction that the Olympics are going, because even in the short time that I've been doing it, the four I've been to since 2008, I've seen how it's become much more corporate. And I worry that as they become even more expensive despite reforms and even more corporate, we're going to see a lot of communist countries, dictatorships take over the role as host. And they're going to be less and less fun to attend and more restrictive on the reporter for various reasons.
And a lot of these burdens and demands are on security.
IOC should cover more of it than it does. I don't know what the proportion is. Maybe you do. But I think at this point, given the what's happening around the world and the obvious target that the Olympics are, it would seem that the IOC should take a more active role in funding and overseeing and perhaps vetting the companies, because whether it's, I remember in London before, right days before, the company that was hired to do security for London threw up his hands and says, you know, we don't have enough people. And they had to call in the army to man the X-ray machines at various venues. And for the first few days of London, it was a little bit of chaos when you were queuing up to get into venues because you had army soldiers who didn't know what exactly, but how well they were supposed to search bags and what they were supposed to do. And I think we're going to see the same thing in Rio because they're hiring a company with very little experience manning X-ray machines. And that it seems like it will be overwhelmed by the traffic it's going to see in Rio. So I think the IOC at this stage may need to, you know, they have their own television company. Right. They may need to have their own security contractor that just comes in. Now, I know this opens it then to a lot of bribery and graft and stuff like that potentially, but they may need to start thinking in terms of, we have our own television arm, but we need to have our own security resources too, because it's just becoming too much of a massive effort. In fact, I was just talking to somebody the other day who had bumped in, who was staying next to one of the people involved with security in Rio, and he was talking to this Rio security official, and the Rio security official was saying basically how they had to revamp all of their protocols after Nice because they hadn't even thought about trucks of any size.
Nice, of course, is Nice, France. Earlier this summer on July 14th, on an open street by the seaside, a man not known previously to French counterterrorism officials took a rather large truck and mowed down 84 people, killing them. 10 of them were children. Another 202 were seriously injured.
So now they're revamping the plans to the point where no truck, small, medium, large, can come within a certain diameter or radius, a certain radius of the Olympic sites or sites.
Which is then going to change all the traffic patterns the pedestrian traffic patterns. And
exactly. And so that was the next thing, which is they're saying, well, that's smart. But now they're having to revamp all the transportation plans. And I've been to Olympics like Vancouver where they didn't have to revamp the transportation plans. And still everything was in complete disarray for the first two or three days. And people were taking 3 hours to travel 5 minutes. So I can see, as I was mentioning before, this sort of snowball effect start going to happen with Rio. Because if you're not prepared in one area, it automatically impacts the other area. It may be a surprise to people to know that the most unsafe I've ever felt at a Games was actually in Vancouver. And it had nothing to
Canada?
Do. Exactly.
Lovely Canada.
Well, everything was smooth and nice once they worked out the early transportation kinks. But what can be the most frightening at an Olympics is when the home country wins a big game or a big event, and then they pour out into the street to celebrate. And I vividly, vividly remember, because I was walking home. It was so safe that I would walk home from the media press center to my hotel, which was about a mile and a half, 2 miles away, and just walk through the city streets of Vancouver at midnight or 1 a.m. And it was no big deal. People were out and about enjoying themselves. It was great. It was balmy, too. It was one of the very balmy Winter Olympics. And then the Canadian men's hockey team won the gold medal.
Oh, that's right.
And thousands, I think it was tens of thousands of people went into the streets of Vancouver, got drunk and partied. And I remember walking back to my hotel. It was one of the last nights I was there. And it was frightening because there were cars driving where they shouldn't have been driving. There were people who just didn't have control of their senses and shouting and yelling and coming up to you and being rough. And it was just, whoa. Oddly enough, the scariest thing had nothing to do with being in a venue or anything like that. It had to be just out in the streets and a sports celebration. So that's a whole other aspect. And I think the police were completely overwhelmed because it was such a dramatic win. I think you can check me on this, but I think it was an overtime.
It was
Sid Crosby scored an overtime goal, and it was so dramatic, and people just sort of literally lost their minds.
And lest we forget, sometimes it's the host country that can be the problem.
And then the other kind of quirky thing that I remember about Beijing was, at first I thought the maids at my hotel were being really, really nice. They always wanted to know, where are you going today, and what event are you going to see? And are you liking it? And how long will you be there? And I thought these were all questions like, you know, we'll do the turndown service before you come back. Kind of that's what they were angling for. No, this was and they all spoke excellent, excellent English, right. The people who worked at the hotel. No, this was very clearly monitoring.
Yeah.
Where are you going to be? When are you going to be there? How long are you going to be there? And it was like daily.
And how long will your room be empty for?
Okay, I should totally staff Shira. I could help her with situations like this.
All right, so you must be talking to athletes and even possibly the USOC. Are they nervous? I mean, we're hearing about some athletes not going. And then famously, Samantha Guthrie, who of today's show, NBC, is the broadcaster, is pregnant. Obviously, she's in the pool of people that ought not to go. The safety and security, they want to be thinking about winning the gold. But all of this background noise, from Zika to crime to pollution to the financial distress, is it impacting them in any way?
So I've talked to a lot of athletes, and they have that typical athlete mentality.
I know, I hate them. They're so happy.
They're so happy, but they are also, you know, exemplars of control what you can control.
Yes.
That is how they live their life. And, you know, anybody who says to me, oh, I just control what I can control, I would kind of roll my eyes and be like, yeah, right. But when an Olympic athlete says to me, I just focus on controlling what I can control, I believe them because that is how they live their life. And keep in mind, these are people who travel around the world competing. And it, you know, very rarely do they enjoy ideal situations. So they are always dealing with some sort of food issue, you know, foodborne illness or some sort of emergent disease or something like that when they travel to certain places. So they're a bit accustomed to dealing with stuff that may arise in a foreign country. And I think also they have the benefit, particularly the very top, what I would call medal contending athletes, they're sponsors, particularly our shoe companies and whatnot, are paying for them essentially to go down and visit Rio beforehand. I know runners who have done that, track and field athletes who've seen the facilities, taken in the city, and that helps to relieve a lot of the anxiety because it's one thing to be thousands upon thousands of miles away and hearing all of this bad publicity, and it's another thing to be standing in Copacabana and say, all right, this isn't so bad. I can deal with this. I mean, I talked to two marathoners who literally came with suitcases full of mosquito repellent. And the first day, they doused themselves, you know, to go out for their run in mosquito repellent. The second day, they were like, we haven't seen any mosquitoes. We'll just back off a little bit. They were there for like 3 or 4 days. The third day, just a little spritz here and there. And by the fourth day, they were just keeping it in their purse and they weren't spraying it on. And they both said to me, if we hadn't have gone, there would have been so much anxiety and so much wasted energy anticipating what we would find there. But now that we know and have negotiated it once before, we're a little calmer. I think the athletes that you hear about backing out because of Zika, you know, you think of the golfers, the big name golfers. Part of that's Zika. Part of that is just, it's not a big deal if you're a golfer to win an Olympic medal. Let's be honest. That's not the end all and be all. They'd rather, you know, win the British Open. I mean, that's more significant to them. So if there's even a little bit of a hint of risk and they're not getting paid for it, why bother? I think is their attitude.
Right. As compared to these athletes who are not making the kind of money that our golf winners are winning or the basketball team is, you know, you look at these numbers and it's amazing that they even survive given how much they're being paid. And they don't have the luxury of big corporate sponsorship.
And this is it for them.
Yeah.
This is it. This is, you know, if you do well in Rio, this could mean not financial security for the rest of your life, but let's say financial security for the next 2, 3, maybe 4, if you're lucky, years of training. That's what they're going for. I mean, their world in some ways is much smaller than, you know, the professional golfer, the, you know, the NBA player.
So they control what they can control.
They can control. That's the attitude.
Yeah. Okay. Can we cue the Olympics music now? So much gloom and doom. Let's talk sports, because all of this talk of the bad things that could happen are really because a remarkable thing is also happening.
I mean, it is an Olympics.
Yeah.
Like, what should we, like, what are you like? Oh, this is going to be the story.
Well, I think definitely what I'm most excited for, if he's healthy enough, is to see Usain Bolt.
I know.
Run in his final.
Have
Olympics.
You ever seen him live?
I have. I was there when his career started. I mean, yeah. I remember being in the bowels of the stadium, the Bird's Nest in Beijing, when he sort of. It wasn't quite a coming out party, because people who follow track and field knew him and knew that he was destined to be a great sprinter. But for the world, it was sort of a coming out party. And I remember just after the semifinal races, and he was just posting times, and we were just like, "Oh my God, this is." And the personality too,
yeah.
You could tell. Already, this is the next great star. I actually had the opportunity. His shoe sponsor, Puma, I believe it's still his shoe sponsor, used to have a Boston-based headquarters. And he came here like a week or two after the Beijing Olympics. And somebody said, "Hey, you want to hang out with Usain Bolt?" And I was like, "Sure." And
sure.
We were like at the Intercontinental Hotel, I think it was.
Why not?
It was just
and
like
Tom Brady's going to drop by.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know.
And we were just, he was doing like a weird fashion photo shoot, which I quite kind of didn't understand what it was about, but I was like, okay, the clothes were all kind of too small for him, but I was like, all right, you do your thing. And then he had to throw out the first pitch at Fenway, so I jumped in the car with him and we drove off to Fenway, and we just had instead of a walk and talk, a drive and talk. Because when you're driving
so
from this,
basically you're telling me you have the best job ever.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
I'm getting it.
So Usain Bolt was is somebody I'm definitely looking forward to. I am really curious to see what happens in the women's marathon, because one, I run marathons, and two, there is Shalane Flanagan from Marblehead, Massachusetts, and Amy Cragg, who's her training partner, who I think have really, really good chances of winning a medal in the women's marathon, which I think will be the first time. I hope I'm getting my history right, but I believe since Dina Castor won bronze in Athens in 2004. So there's been a pretty significant gap women's marathon winners for the U.S. So I'm excited about that. And I'm just excited to see how the whole thing comes together. I'm excited to get into some of the historic stadiums like the Maracanã, which is a very, very famous soccer stadium. I'm going to take in a soccer game at some point, men's, women's, I'm not sure. But I want to just have that feeling of being in Brazil and watching soccer in a country that views it as a religion. I think that will be an exciting experience. I just think I also like to just, swimming doesn't, some of the swimming, I was going to say swimming doesn't really excite me. I think swimming, does that excite me?
Your editors are like, edit that. Edit
yeah,
that.
I was like, yeah. But I mean, I don't know. It's not, for some people, that's their thing. I tend to like some of the more quirkier sports, or some of the sports that don't get all the fanfare regularly. Like, I've become a big fan of fencing. I actually had an opportunity to take on, at the time, he was the number 5 ranked saber fencer in the world. Then he practiced with me, and his ranking has just plummeted. I think I destroyed his confidence. But, you know, I'm looking to see there's what emerges too. I think that's one of the fun things about the Olympics. There's always an athlete sometimes that just sort of comes out of the woodwork, and you're like, oh my God, this is such a cool, interesting story. I never knew about him, her. And sometimes they're just stories that come up that you're not expecting, or that you want to draw attention to. For example, in London, it was the number of women participating in the games. London was the first Olympics where every country had a female athlete participating. I think it's going to happen again. I just heard that Saudi Arabia is sending 4 women, which is pretty incredible.
Wow, yes.
So all of that is exciting to see how that all turns out. And then there's some things that, you know, you hope you get to do, like in Beijing at the end of the track competition, we got to sneak onto the track and run a lap, which is pretty cool. So you just get to run a lap after watching the whole competition. a friend of mine, a colleague from Denver, snapped a picture with me because apparently by the time I was I was one of the last because we were all taking pictures of each other. So I said, I'll take a picture of you. I'll take a picture. Then I got out and did my own lap. And apparently by the time I got out there, this Chinese security army folks who were watching the stadium caught on to what we were doing and were not happy. So at the picture, like the tail end of the picture of me, there's like two army officers running after me as I'm like crossing the 400 meter finish on the track. But so there's some sort of out of the paper, off right. camera, though that was we're taking pictures, but sort of we don't report on, but we just get to experience.
So you're going to break my heart. And I'm going to ask this last question. So yes. Given all of the issues with Rio and security, that would suggest that L.A. is going to have a very good chance for 2024.
Oh, I think it has an excellent chance. God. I think it has an excellent chance. I mean, just looking at the way things are in Europe at this point, I mean, I don't know. What do you have? Paris in there. Rome is in there. I don't know how in you can if you're the IOC. I hate to say this, but I feel comfortable awarding, you know, the 2024 Olympics to a place like Paris at this point. I mean, I just think the security concern would be overwhelming and be just a really, you know, they sort of rate everything when they're weighing different host cities. I mean, I just think that would be a real big stumbling block for members of the IOC. So I don't see how you can do that. LA seems like the smart choice for a lot of reasons, not least of which it'll have been a long time since you've had a Games in North America. There'll be Asia, Europe. So it seems like they're due for a North American Games to begin with. They also have the confidence that LA has experience doing this. It has the capacity to welcome everybody. It has the facilities largely built. And let's be honest, many of the sponsors, Olympic sponsors, are American companies, and they'd be happy to have them in L.A. So I think L.A. is the odds-on favorite at
this
point.
So like in 8 years, can I staff you?
Yes, you can staff me.
That's my job, people.
Exactly. But, you know, and the interesting thing is what you're seeing, though, it's so hard to predict. Yeah. 2024 is a long, long way away. And I think that's – we have this lesson every time there's an Olympics – just how long that 7-year period is from winning the Games till hosting it.
Think if Istanbul could have gotten it and then what's
exactly.
going on there. Also, can you imagine the IOC giving it to us if Trump is president?
Oh, that's an interesting point.
I had not thought about
that. That's a really interesting point. I mean, let's not forget, Brazil 7 years ago
was the
rising economy of South America and, quite frankly, of the world. It was one of the four or five economies that everybody was keeping an eye on and saying, here's the model, look what they've done.
Okay, I may not know much about Canadian hockey, but I do know what Shira is talking about here. She's referring actually to four economies known as the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, that were once thought to be sort of emerging powerhouses in the global economic environment. It's still true to some extent of Russia, India, and China, although they are all having their problems. It is certainly no longer true of Brazil.
You know, everybody was praising how they had come out of, what is it, dictatorship and political chaos and become this exemplar. Mm. And here we are today thinking, oh my God, what were they thinking?
Do you know what my answer is to this?
Yes.
Boston 2024.
No.
I was joking, people. A girl can dream.
You know what my answer is to this? Permanent host sites.
Oh, that's smart.
Permanent host sites. I really think that we should be thinking, the IOC should be thinking about 5 Olympic, Summer Olympic sites and 5 Winter Olympic sites, and you rotate them through. And I know people are going to object and say, but what about, you know, how it exposes new cities to the world and this, that, and the other, and it gives everybody an opportunity, and don't you want people to know more about Lillehammer, and you'll never have a Games there again, and this, that, and the other. I said, I get where you're coming from, but the Olympics is much different than when it was held in Lillehammer. It's just physically too big an enterprise, and security-wise, too big an enterprise to be awarding it to cities who have no experience hosting events this large and really, really don't know what to do. And it's like experiential learning with these cities, too. Sometimes you just don't know what to do until you've done it once. And they can't benefit a lot of times from the best knowledge of hosting because they don't have an opportunity to do it again. So I think permanent host sites, a rotation of 4 or 5 cities, summer and winter, a lot of your problems, a lot of your anxiety will be solved surrounding the games.
Yes, there is a lot of anxiety surrounding the games. In times of unrest, economic uncertainty, public health pandemics, regular crime, and a nation known more for fun than its capacity to host and organize event, the Rio Olympics will be anxious, but they will also be something else. Sometimes I wonder why someone like me in safety and security, homeland security, counterterrorism, sort of so much enjoys the Olympics. And I think it is something about this hope that they represent. And maybe they're too corporate now, or maybe there's too much corruption, who knows. But the hope that they represent, that there's at least one remaining forum where so many countries can come together, stop fighting, and just compete. And it's the hope in the eyes of a young athlete, right? That I control only what I can control. If only the world were that simple. This is Juliette Kayyem with the Security Mom Podcast, brought to you by WGBH News, produced by Catherine Whelan with engineering help from Doug Shugarts. Cue the music. Somebody. Not that music.